Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this special bonus episode of the Late Night with Seth Meyers podcast. Today you'll hear an exclusive conversation between Seth and Ezra Klein, editor-in-chief of Vox, recorded just for this podcast. They discuss the rapidly changing political world and the role media plays in it. Now, let's go to Seth and Ezra.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Late Night Podcast. I'm here with Ezra Klein. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm wonderful. We're going to talk tonight on the show. I'm very excited to have you as a guest. Thank you for also doing the podcast. You host...
I'm mainly here for the podcast. The show...
Well, you were just saying you think podcasts are the only media that's not depressing right now.
Yeah, podcasts are media still fun.
It is nice.
Everything else is very tightly packaged. Podcasts are where things happen that still surprise me.
I agree with that. I also am surprised when I have the patience for in a podcast. When someone tells me a movie's over 2 hours, I immediately think I'm never going to see that movie. But I'll easily listen to 2 hours of podcasts and not think that anything.
So I have a theory about this.
Yeah.
And it's why I actually like podcasting so much. So virtually every other kind of media, book, a television show, an article on a website, it's the first thing you're doing. It needs to hold your entire attention.
Yes.
Podcasting, I don't know how you do it, but it's almost always the second thing you're doing.
Yeah.
You listen to it while you're walking your dog, while you're
running,
driving. While I really like cleaning my house and listening to podcasts.
Yeah.
Like, that is when I listen to podcasts. And the what it asks of you to keep your attention as a secondary activity is so much less, and so you can go so much longer.
Yeah.
And it has this completely different dynamic as a piece of media because – in some ways, like for a lot of what you're doing, it's annoying to me if I have to change out a podcast. If I'm driving or I'm walking my dogs, the last thing I want to be doing is fumbling with my phone. So, I mean, to have a medium that actually rewards sort of length and intimacy and being able to relax into something for an extended period of time, it's such a cool thing to get to play around with.
I also think because of the way podcasts work, that they're conversational. I used to think books on tape were great, but there is that thing, if you can drift off on a book on tape and realize, oh, I have to go back, I just missed a plot point. There is less of that in podcasts. So you can have a moment of distraction in a podcast and you're actually okay because it's conversational and it's easier to go back and pick up what the context of what's happening and what you missed.
So yeah, I've not been able to do books on tape. I don't know why.
Yeah, I did back in the day. That was a Myers family road trip staple. And
oh,
now
yeah?
I can't believe.
What did you listen to?
When we were traveling, again, this is a while back, the first time, my favorite book is Catch-22. The first time I absorbed it was via book on tape. My parents played it for us on a road trip. A lot of Gene Shepard. I don't know if you're familiar with Gene Shepard. He's the Christmas Story, that famous Christmas movie. He wrote that. And then he wrote a lot of other books that were about those characters. And that was... that was a real staple too. So you host two podcasts, or you don't? You host one, and then it's you and two others.
I co-host another. Yeah.
Yeah.
So The Weeds, which is where the co-hosted one, where we argue about policy twice a week, which is a lot of fun, and is nice because you can really, again, just go deep. And then the Ezra Klein Show, which is where I do sort of long form interviews.
You just did a long form interview with Hillary Clinton.
Yes,
that was excellent.
Thank you.
It strikes me that. And tell me what you think of this. Because you're so wonky, she's actually more comfortable talking to someone like you than other interviewers. Because I think she appreciates that you actually know everything she laid out during the campaign. You're not actually asking her to explain it again. And I don't know, I felt like you got the best out of her.
I appreciate that. It was great fun to do the interview. I have a couple thoughts on that because I've seen that dynamic with politicians. So one is that Hillary Clinton is now post-election.
Yeah.
And there is this cliche in politics that everybody becomes looser and more confident and more chill after the election, right? The whole Al Gore effect, where it's like during the election, Al Gore is this terrible stiff who nobody likes. And after the election, look, he grew a beard.
Yeah, he's hosting SNL.
He's on The Simpsons. Yeah. He's on SNL. But there is a truth to that cliche, right? I mean, that's why it's a cliche. People do become a little more willing to talk freely after the election and after they have a little bit less to lose. But the other thing, and this is part of how I think about doing interviews in general. I'd be curious for how you think about this. I think journalism has prized in interviewing a performance of toughness that does not get the best out of its subjects.
Yeah.
So there is a tendency as a journalist to go into one of these interviews and begin with the most controversial piece of it, the place where the person is the most defensive and protected, the place where they've already rehearsed all their answers. And so I often see that. And you see somebody go into these interviews. And so the first question is, in your book, you said about Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
And then the wall goes up. She already knows exactly what she's going to say. It's actually an easy question for her to answer. And then from there, the whole thing is this pretty premeditated dance. So I think that oftentimes when you ask politicians much simpler questions about policy, about places where they're not as rehearsed, you get a lot more out of them. And sometimes they get into a lot more trouble in terms of this question of what is a tough interview versus not a tough interview, because they have to think. I think we have a real problem where every interview with these folks is exactly the same. So they really know what they're saying. And, you know, we do this thing where we get to show off that, you know, we're making them uncomfortable, but we're not actually getting that much out of them. So the wonky, I do it from a sort of policy perspective because that's what I know. But I think you can do it from a lot of perspectives. I think that it's just one question that it'd be good, I would like to see asked more, is what is a different interview than the one they've been giving every day all the time?
I certainly found, and I've often said that I find politicians the hardest, but particularly politicians during an election cycle. We tried to have as many of the candidates on during the primary season, and I feel like they're more likely to answer the question they wish you had asked as opposed to the one you asked, especially when they have sort of stump speech, you know, stories and anecdotes that obviously they feel have tested well and their team have told them is a great story and you should try to get that out on TV. And it's sometimes, and this is a fault of mine, I find myself getting bored into doing a bad interview. I feel like I just I concede that this is not going to go anywhere. But I will say, she was great. We had a Hillary on during the campaign, and she was really fun and loose. I felt like we got a great interview out of her. And yeah, it's strange, but I do feel like, and again, she has a lot of reasons to have issues with the media, and there were a lot of things she had to answer over and over and over again. But that was what I really enjoyed about this. And one of the things you presented to her, and I think she obviously enjoyed talking about, and I'd like to, if you don't mind, sort of restating it, that she ran against two people, Bernie and Donald, who sort of promised big things and then never really had to account for how they were going to deliver them. And how you sort of asked her if she had regrets about not being sort of a candidate who promises big things without the backing to it.
So her book is interesting on this. And I think that a lot of the book is self-justification. Not always wrong, by the way. I think it's more or less, it's broadly accurate, if not always accurate. But one of the places where she clearly has unsettled feelings about how she ran her own campaign was that she felt that she was running as president-to-be.
Mm-hmm.
And both due to her own temperament and her own understanding of what was responsible to do, but also how she felt the media would treat her, it was important that the proposals she brought out were realistic, pragmatic. She could explain how they were going to be paid for, how they were going to be implemented. And she ran against candidates who, in different ways, Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump, but broadly others as well, and I think this is actually true in some ways for Obama in 2008, who she ran against, who were much more able to make sweeping critiques of the system, who were more able, particularly with Sanders and Trump, to come out with policies that were ambitious and inspiring and not as locked down or realistic in the details. And so one of the things that really struck me in the book is she talks about having gotten interested in running on a universal basic income in 2016. So she had this idea that she got from a book called, I think, With Liberty and Dividends for All. And the idea is, what if you take shared national, the profits that come from shared natural resources like fossil fuel extraction, and also from taxing public harms like carbon emissions and high-speed financial trading, and what if you turned that money into a modest basic income for everyone?
And you pointed out this actually happens in Alaska.
So, right. So this is the way they think about this is she wanted to call it Alaska for America. Because, yeah, as you say, Alaska has this thing called the Permanent Reserve Fund. So they have huge oil and gas extraction. They turn that around. I think it's about an $8,000 check for everybody in Alaska. It's a very, very successful policy. Now, I think, by the way, you see here a little bit of both. There are reasons that are interesting that Clinton did this, and then reasons that reflect maybe some problems of her in that campaign. Because she says to me in the interview, well, when we tried to explain Alaska to America for people, you know, people don't know what's going on in Alaska. And I kept thinking, Alaska has nothing to do with this idea.
Like, right.
You've gotten very fastened on a policy precursor, but this is not about Alaska, right? So possibly one reason it didn't make in the campaign was the messaging. But the other was that as she kept looking at it, to make an income like that work, the taxes had to be pretty high. And you could just tell that, and she says this, that she ends up being concerned that she's just going to get tagged for this huge tax increase. And so she says at the end of this chapter, or in this chapter, but I don't know, looking back, maybe I shouldn't have worried so much about the details and the math, and I should have made it an aspirational policy and something that you could, and we could work out the details later. And that's one of those very interesting, you know, branching paths of history. What if her campaign had been built around a couple really big, really ambitious ideas in the way that Trump had the wall and Bernie Sanders had single-payer healthcare and free college? And I don't know, she says, and I do think she's right about this, that she would not have been treated the way they were treated. It would not have been okay with the press for her to have something that she couldn't really defend exactly, or she couldn't really explain. I think that's right. But I also think, and we talked about this in our discussion, that part of it is her, that is a that critique would have bothered her,
right?
In a way that when somebody says to Donald Trump, that won't work, he doesn't care.
Yeah.
The critique doesn't bother him. He doesn't stop to answer it. The whole thing, like the whole system just doesn't respond to it. To some degree, that's a little bit true. And I don't like to compare Trump and Sanders because I think they're very, very different personalities. But when you tell, we just interviewed Bernie Sanders about his single payer plan. And when you confront Sanders with something that maybe in his plan doesn't add up or will be difficult, he tends to just not even admit that there's a problem here.
Yeah.
And so I really do think there's something with politicians of it's not just like an objective reality about what kind of critique is dangerous for them. It's also what kind of critique they care about and they will treat as problematic for them.
Yes. I think, to be fair, or I don't know if it's fair or not, but not only do we, I feel like people, when Hillary says I'm being held to a higher standard, I think it's also true to say that she's holding herself to a higher standard, as a lot of politicians do. That she wasn't willing to say things that she didn't have. She never wanted to say anything where she wasn't willing to show the work. You mentioned details. By the way, I think that's admirable of hers. You mentioned details and sort of big ideas and then having to deal with the details. Right now, obviously, we're seeing a presidency that's having to deal with the details. You mentioned the wall specifically. This week, we're sort of seeing that the wall now is becoming a little bit more vague and what it actually is. Have you been – is this exactly what you expected from
Donald
Trump?
It's a metaphor of a wall.
Yeah, exactly. It's going to be but is this what you expected, or is it even clumsier than you expected as far as how he's trying to move forward on these big ideas that he did not do any of the detail work on beforehand?
It's clumsier than I expected. I have a lot of trouble with the question of what I expected because,
yeah,
honest
same.
Truth, did not expect any of it.
No, I mean, I certainly didn't expect him to win. So, yeah.
So there's that. There's a little bit of a hard. I very often have this feeling of living in a dream.
Yeah.
Of just being like, this doesn't seem realistic.
Yeah.
Like, there's no way this is what's actually going on. The Trump administration has been, when he won and when I saw who he was appointing, I thought they would run a more conventionally competent administration than they have. I thought that, you know, here's a guy who's clearly an eccentric personality, but has definitely run a business empire of some sort. They really did build buildings. Those buildings are standing for the most part, right? They
yep.
don't fall down.
There's right.
not, it's like there are no
You wouldn't
sinks
be terrified to be at the top floor.
Right, exactly.
right.
And so clearly he can delegate.
Yeah.
He was naming people to positions who, even if they were not the people I would have named to these positions, in many cases were clearly competent and capable.
Sure. It was the sort of people you'd expect a party that maybe you didn't agree with mm-hmm. to name.
And then it's like they turned on the machine and just smoke came out of everything. And I mean, the problem is really at the top.
They filled it up with diesel.
Right? The problem is really at the top that Trump himself will not send clear signals to his own staff, will not back people up, does not himself have stable preferences. So people will begin acting in one way, expecting that's what he wants from them. And then he will flip on them. And so then all of what they've been doing doesn't work, is not able to resolve infighting within his own staff. Now, maybe we're coming more out of that period than we were 3 months ago. Bannon's gone. A lot of key people are gone. And it does seem like things are a little bit more stable in terms of staffing under Chief of Staff Kelly. But it has been much more chaotic, much less competent than I expected, even when I had quite low expectations. The other thing that I do think is interesting is I expected the Trump that we have been seeing in the last couple of weeks to be the Trump we saw at the beginning.
Right.
So this is a guy who used to be a Democrat, mm-hmm. has spent his life in New York, has given much more money to Democratic politicians, I think. Certainly has given a lot of money to Democratic politicians, had a long pre-existing relationship with Chuck Schumer, had donated to Chuck Schumer in the House.
Has multiple photos of him with people who mm-hmm. are very angry with him now. So and he had pre-existing relationships.
I expected what was going to happen was he was going to come in and sort of try to put himself between the two parties. Because he doesn't care about details, he, as far as I can tell, what actually happened is he had other people staff his administration. He did not apply any kind of ideological litmus test to them in a serious way. He did not make it so that the people around him reflected
his. Do you
his
think
views.
He has an ideological
That's the
yeah,
issue.
Base?
He, to an extent that I think the single thing that was the biggest surprise for everybody trying to operate in Washington, in and around the White House, in my reporting, was it took some time for people to update their model of Donald Trump from he doesn't care about the details of policy, but he has quite strong basic intuitions about policy, right? He doesn't care about how you build your wall, but he really cares about a wall, or he doesn't really care about what's in the trade deal, but he has like strong views about, you know, America not getting ripped off. He actually doesn't have any strong views at all.
Yeah.
He states weakly held views very strongly. And so then everybody hears him because he speaks with so much confidence and bluster and braggadocio. And I mean, everything he says is 100% black and white. And so you think, okay, well, this guy is not going to budge on the wall. I mean, if there's anything that is true, he will not budge on the wall, or he'll send out dozens of tweets about I'm the only Republican who will not cut Medicaid. So whatever else he's going to do, he's not going to cut Medicaid. And then he just does.
Yeah.
And it has been a real updating process for people to recognize that it's not just that he's not going to get involved in the details. It's that he doesn't care about the big picture either. He just wants to be praised. Like, that is his one true North Star.
That's good. That's healthy. I want to talk about the details of Vox, because I find what you guys are doing really interesting and cool, and I enjoy consuming it. You have a ton of podcasts. You have a ton of videos. You have videos with wonderful graphics that are explaining things that I do not feel like are treated with that much flair usually. How are you finding technology has changed the kind of storytelling you can do on your website?
So it's really, really profound. And I think this is one of these places where I think we are really at the beginning of how we tell stories, how we convey information is going to change. So, you know, just what you were saying a second ago, that that part of Vox is audio and video, that just wasn't, I mean, I worked at the Washington Post before. I mean, 15 years ago, it was a huge deal that newspapers began printing color photographs, right? Like, because ink was expensive.
Right.
Like, it's so crazy how far we've come, how fast. Now all these operations in New York Times, Post, us, we have these big video departments. I think there are three really big differences in how we can tell stories right now. One is that you can have any length you want, which I don't think people even now recognize how much of journalism, both on television and in print, was about how do you pack the most into the shortest amount of time.
Yeah.
It's like you only have an hour and there are commercial breaks in set places. The newspaper only has so many pages. Everything was about condensing. And now you don't have to condense.
Yeah.
I always make this quasi joke that, did you ever read Clickhole, the Onion?
Sure, yeah.
Viral news send up. They had this one article that was entitled, My Time on a Whaling Ship Totally Changed My Life. Uh-huh. And it was just the entire text of Moby Dick, which is a good joke. But also then they just published everything else they wanted to publish that day.
Yeah.
And the idea that you could publish the entire text of Moby Dick and then whatever you want, we are nowhere in understanding what that means for us. The second is persistence, that things don't go away. They're there forever. You can update them. You can change them. You can bring them back. Newspapers, you throw them out the next day. TV, like the second you say it, nobody will ever see it ever again for any reason, no matter how useful and incisive it was. So this idea that you're now creating these libraries of content, that really changes the upfront editorial process. You mentioned our videos. One of the things we do, I think it's pretty different than other places and certainly than other news outlets, is I think at news outlets, usually the question is, what is the newest thing we can do? What just happened? In our video team, and also in parts of our text operation, we actually ask the question, what is a video we're going to be able to use the most number of times? Right? Mm-hmm. Can we explain something that's going to come back and come back and come back so that is useful to the audience 10 times, not one time?
Your Syria video, would that be a good example?
Yep. So we did, a 7-minute explanation of the Syrian civil war. It's now been viewed, watched more than 120 million times. So, I mean, that's more than, like, you remember BuzzFeed's address?
Yeah.
Like, we had a Syrian civil war explanation that, like, got seen more times than BuzzFeed's address. It's just amazing to me. And that had, it had multiple huge cycles that happened months and months and months apart from each other, because the war would come back into people's consciousness. I mean, it never stopped in reality, but it would come back into people's consciousness here, and then they would want that explanation. And I think for one of the more recent ones, we added more to the video. We changed the video so it was valuable to people again. And then the final thing is, as you said, we used to be, the media as an industry, really specific in what kind of content, each specialized in what kind of content everybody did. Newspapers did print and photographs, and television did television, and radio did audio. And now everything is mixed together, and there are things we didn't even have the capability to do, interactives. We just did this piece on Vox, which is one of our most viewed pieces ever, where you could put in your zip code and you would see what you would see in the solar eclipse wherever you lived, and then where you had to go to see other amounts. And just the ability that you could personalize the news for yourself, that's completely new. We didn't have that 15 years ago. We didn't have that 10 years ago. So we are really, I think, at the beginning of how different storytelling would be. I always imagine, like, what if we had just invented journalism right now around this technology? And it would clearly not look like what we have.
Yeah.
And I think we're a long way from shedding tradition on that, and just how much it unconsciously shapes what we believe we're doing to create the next things.
Another thing I want to talk to you about, you mentioned your Syria piece was 7 minutes. I don't know if that was before or after you added stuff, but it seems like there was this idea about millennial viewers that they had a certain attention span. And I can even speak to our show, which we're not even 4 years in. There was this idea about late night content that the shorter the better. People are going to watch it on their phones. Nobody can watch anything on their phone for longer than 2 minutes. And it's completely, the landscape for us has completely changed, in that the most popular things that we do are the longest, as long as they sort of have, for lack of a better term, caloric content. Like, they actually have something meaningful to them. Is that something you would have predicted, that people will stick around for a sort of longer form work and they have that attention span for it?
Yes, because I'm a farsighted genius.
Yeah. caught me off guard, man.
I mean, I had seen this before at the Post, where I ran a vertical called Wonk Blog, which is policy content, and we were the most popular vertical at the Post. And, like, that wasn't supposed to have happened, right?
Right.
It wasn't. You didn't get huge audiences to write about healthcare policy. I think that we continuously disrespect the audience. I don't really know why. I am technically a millennial. I'm, like, sort of the outer edge of millennialism. And so I will read people write about putatively me, and it has no relationship to my life or the people I know. Generations are big. I never understand this kind of generational analysis.
Yeah.
There's so many people.
There's so many people, and still I can't even pretend like I'm a millennial. I work with millennials. I think they think I'm cool, but then again, I'm their boss, so they're probably faking it.
There's no way they think you're cool.
Yeah, they don't.
I like that.
I would like to point out that
I'm
wearing...
sure my employees think I'm cool. That's good.
I would like to say...
That's like the most Michael Scott.
I would like to, just for those... I am wearing a hoodie and jeans and sneakers
right
now.
You look much cooler than I do at the
moment. But I'm wearing sneakers that are very wide-soled because my feet have been hurting the last 5 years.
I'm wearing, just so people know, a dress shirt currently covered in salad dressing.
Yeah.
which is an important sartorial decision I made today at lunch. I think that people like good content. I think they always have. I don't think it has to be long. I don't think there's a sort of... I do think that one reason long stuff works better oftentimes is a little bit of an analytical mistake. We put more effort into longer things. The reason they become longer is that they get through an editorial process and people are like, that is such a good idea that you can go to 5,000 words or you can go to 15 minutes or whatever it might be. So to some degree, I don't think it's just that people like long for the sake of long, but they also don't like short for the sake of short. We were talking about podcasts earlier. I mean, people need different things at different moments. You know, what you want to read before you go to bed is different than what you want to read right before a meeting. It's different than what you want to watch at home from what you want to watch, when you're kind of zoning out at lunch at work. I think people like good stuff. I think that one defense mechanism the media journalism had early in the internet was to dismiss the rise of competitors by saying it's garbage.
Yeah.
And that's something you see continuously, like in different technological eras. There's a line that the next big thing always begins as a toy, right? You always dismiss what's coming. But then it just turns out that people want good stuff, but you got to figure out how to do it. It's actually not that easy. And I don't know. I've always been very rewarded by what the audience actually wants. I think too often we do bad work and then blame them. And I've always found that if we do good work, they'll be there for it.
So I've heard you say, and I think some of you believe, that where good work would be really important right now, because I feel like international and certainly on the national level, there's a lot of great people doing incredibly good work about this administration right now, about the issues. I feel like you can be more informed on healthcare than you ever could have been before. On the state and local level, that strikes me as the scariest place, because that's not a place, and tell me if I'm wrong, where Vox could have a business model to be local and successful. And it seems like that's where the papers are going away. Do you think that there's any future for media on the state and local level to succeed the way it has on the national level?
Yeah, so this is harder. So one, my co-founder, Melissa Bell, would kill me if I didn't say no, Vox could have.
Good.
She's wanted to be
Vox
local forever.
I would like you to take it on. Good.
And we just haven't done it yet. But your broad point is right, and it does scare me. You can get better international and national news than you ever could before right now. I mean, there is more of it accessible to you. I come from California. Even if I want to get more Sacramento reporting on the biggest state in the union, the fifth biggest economy in the world, I really can't.
Yeah.
There's just not that much out there. I mean, it's not none, but the LA Times is a shell of its former self. The Sacramento Bee is a shell of its former self. And we have seen the real destruction of these organizations. And one of the reasons, I think, is that it turns out the way people follow the news is a little bit as a hobby, a little bit as an identity mechanism. And so they're more interested. They've always been more interested in the big national stories, in the sort of red versus blue teams, and in the same ways they're interested in sports. Actually, sports is a terrible example. In the same way they're interested in things that are not sports.
Right.
Because sports is one of the last things keeping local journalism actually alive. I have long had the view, which is not that popular in journalism, that local journalism, local media should be state subsidized. That has happened in other countries. There are different ways to do it. You wouldn't want it done in a sort of way where the state had control, but there are ways you can have grants or ways you can have tax subsidies to make it easier to fund these things through philanthropy. This stuff is really, really important. You have seen some real efforts to do philanthropy in these areas, in these ways. It's not that the business model can't work. It's just that it's very hard to make it work, and it may not happen in time. But yeah, I mean, what you're saying is true. I'll also say that part of the issue with that is that in addition to just not having the information, you don't have the accountability that just used to happen. And so we're in an era when, for all that we're panicked about the White House, and or some people are, obviously some people are not, there is a lot of scrutiny. A lot of scrutiny on Congress, a lot of scrutiny on the executive agencies. It's not perfect, but it's there. What is happening, I mean, states spend a huge amount of money. What they do affects everybody's lives, cities the same way. And it is happening with very little accountability. And, you know, I think it would be reasonable to expect that the quality of governance has deteriorated in part for that reason. And that's really bad. I mean, that will really hurt people's lives. So I think this is a real problem.
Okay, well, get on it. I'm going to put you on it. Last thing I want to ask you, and then I look forward to talking tonight. Have you, I know you spent a lot of time following healthcare. You certainly were a huge student of the Affordable Care Act. I feel like you and – can I just shout out Sarah Cliff, who feel like I know more about healthcare from her than anyone.
We all know more about healthcare from Sarah Cliff than anyone.
And I encourage everybody to watch you guys interview President Obama about it, because that was fantastic as well.
And you can learn more about Sarah Cliff from healthcare, about healthcare from Sarah Cliff every week on The Weeds.
On The Weeds.
Wherever you get your fine podcasts.
There you go. I am a big fan of hers. But I also want to ask, did you ever – expect to see something so poorly handled as the GOP repeal Obamacare? And who do you blame it on? Because that seems like maybe not, you can't peg it on Donald Trump.
I agree with that. And no, I was genuinely shocked. I had expected that they would not be able to replace Obamacare, which, who knows, maybe I'll be wrong in the future still. But I thought once that was locked in, they might be able to tweak it, they might be able to wound it, but to take health insurance away from 25 million people, you aren't going to be able to do that. So I wasn't surprised when the whole thing failed. What I was surprised by was how far the single worst policymaking process I have ever seen or could possibly imagine went, and how honestly, intellectually and morally bankrupt it exposed various players as. So I will use an example here that puts to the side whatever you think about the policy, right? I was not going to like a policy that took insurance away from 25 million people. That's just like, let's bank that. During the Affordable Care Act process, after the Affordable Care Act process, I spoke to dozens and dozens of Republicans, of members of Congress, of staffers, and one of the things that they were so genuinely heated about was that they felt the process that led to the Affordable Care Act was partisan, was against the founding structures and institutions of this country, was itself an affront to America's system of government. And they all said it. I mean, Paul Ryan said this. Mitch McConnell said this. Mitch McConnell gave this speech in 2014. I believe it's called Restoring the Senate. And he talked about how if he had been majority leader and he was passing this bill and not a single person on the other side wanted to vote for it, he might think, maybe this is not a good idea. Maybe we shouldn't do this. He talked about running a more open Senate with more meetings and more open hearings and more testimony. So they get a hold of this and they take what they said Democrats were doing, which I think Democrats actually ran a reasonably open process and really did try to get bipartisan support. There were endless committee hearings that I covered. There were a ton of Republican amendments that were added to the bill. The Gang of Six, which is half Republican, went into this back room for months and months to try to work out a compromise. But Republicans felt in the end that to pass a bill on a party line vote that was that big and use the sort of 51 vote reconciliation process at the end, it was just awful. So then they get power. They begin by using the 51 vote reconciliation process. They begin by saying publicly they're not going to look for any Democratic support, which is just shocking, actually, not even try.
Yeah.
That you just don't see. You see people give up. You barely ever see them not try. They hold no open hearings anywhere. The bills they release at every stage in the process had never been seen before. So it wasn't like they crafted it and then it was out for a little while. They would like release it and try to get a vote as quickly as they could. Then they would change it and try to get a vote as quickly as they could in the House. They didn't even wait for a final estimate of what their bill would do. Not even a final. They didn't wait for an estimate of what their final bill would do before passing it out of the House. They actually didn't want to know. That to me was always a thing there. It wasn't they didn't want us to know. I don't think they wanted to
right,
know.
It would have
like
made
it was too depressing.
Yeah,
like, they
the
just
news
had to get it out.
Maybe too bad.
At the end, they found themselves, I mean, literally, the farce we ended in was the final day of this. Republican senators, 49 of 51, 49 of 52 Republican senators voted for a bill that their literal view of it was that they would only vote for it on the assurance that it would not become law.
Yeah.
That was how crazy this got. And so in addition to a bad process, in addition to an incredibly irresponsible process, nobody thought these bills were well drafted or would actually work, including Republicans. In addition to all that, for Mitch McConnell, for Paul Ryan, for all these folks who I've covered for years, I think it just really raises a question of how, if you cover them, you are supposed to take what they say as credible. I feel like I covered a lot of Republicans complaining about the Obamacare process, and I covered it. I tried to cover it in good faith. Sometimes would argue with it, but tried to convey that that's how they felt. And I feel like I just misinformed my audience. They didn't really believe that, not in a serious way, not in a way that's going to inform any of their actions. What they said, if I had covered Mitch McConnell's 2014 speech, I actually didn't, but it would have totally been reasonable to say this guy might be majority leader. I'm going to cover his speech explaining how he will run the Senate. If I had covered that, this is what the other guy wants to do. It should help inform your voting decisions. I'd have just lied to the audience. I didn't know I would have been lying, but Mitch McConnell didn't mean any of that. And I don't know. I mean, obviously people are jaded about politicians. I am jaded about politicians. People are cynical about them. I am cynical about them. There's a lot of exaggerating, misdirection, spin. I mean, it's all there. There's not usually directional lying, not never, but it's not like such a prevalent feature of the thing for a lot of reasons. In part because what you're saying, you can get held to later, because what you say is a way that your allies end up taking signals about what they need to do. I mean, what you're saying matters. And so they put a lot of work into it. And this world that Donald Trump has helped create, but he's not by any means the only one. The other Republicans are just as much part of it, even if they present themselves in a more conventional package.
Well, that, I think, is the great gift that Donald Trump has given them, this sort of covering fire of he's so outrageous that their sort of sober lies seem like truths.
But so there is now this complete Calvin ball happening in Washington where nothing anybody says, certainly on the Republican side, has any relationship necessarily to what they'll do. And that's a really hard space in which to do journalism, in which to be a voter, in which to be even an interest group or an advocate or anything in Washington trying to get things done. I mean, people joke about and talk about alternative facts and fake news, but Washington now stands on informational quicksand. And that's a very dangerous foundation on which to build your government.
But a very exciting time to write and talk about it. So I think we're in the right business.
Yeah, it's good for us.
Yeah. And
Crisis
I can't wait to have
brand.
You. Exactly. I can't wait to have you on the show tonight. Thanks so much for making time for us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
All right. See you soon, Ezra.
You can't see this, but we're shaking hands.
I don't know why I did that. We just did the most awkward handshake around two microphones. Thank you for calling that out. That was really rookie podcasting.
Well, I wanted everybody to know. I felt
to know how jocular this was. Yeah. All right. Thanks, man.
Our guest is the founder and editor-in-chief of Vox. He co-hosts the Weeds podcast and hosts the Ezra Klein Show podcast. Please welcome to the show, Ezra Klein, everybody. I'm so happy you're here. I don't want you to think I only drink with the ladies, so here
Thank
is
you.
A whiskey for you. I think that's your drink.
Yes, I feel very peer pressured into this. So.
Okay, good. Well, you don't have to drink much of it. I'm going to make you talk most
Everybody's coming out with their cool alcohol stories. Again, at bar fights in Budapest. You can't be the politics nerd. I'll have water.
Yeah, exactly. So you had to do this. This is all for show.
Yes.
So I want to talk about Vox. You guys do sort of what you would call an explanatory journalism that helps people understand complicated political issues. Has it been made harder by the fact that under the Trump administration, you have a president who does not care about the complicated details of issues?
It hasn't been made easier. So the tricky thing about the Trump administration isn't that he doesn't care, but that the informational universe that he's at the center of has collapsed. So the things that he says are not a guide to what he will do, to what he thinks. The things that his staffers say do not really have a steady relationship to the things that he will do in the next couple of days. And so you have this sort of whole world of people who a big part of their job is to generate information that everybody else uses to at least take signals of where the government is going. And that just takes hard turns every couple of days.
Yeah, he's basically a weather vane in a tornado that's just like whipping around. And so it's wrong to think
David Brooks once said it's 8 fireflies in a jar.
That sounds about right. You talked about the... Explain to me this idea of the hierarchy of how we judge President Trump.
So I've talked before about the Maslow's hierarchy of political needs.
Maslow's hierarchy.
Yeah, so this is Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right, which is like food and shelter at the top, and then like all the way at the bottom, do you have the new iPhone?
Right. Okay, gotcha.
I'm sorry, all the way at the top, do you have the new iPhone?
Okay.
And I feel like you have that in politics, too. You have at the top, is this a good policy? Is the process in the White House running well? Are they making sort of the right marginal decision? And then we have fallen way, way, way down the pyramid to, does the president sort of sympathize with white supremacists?
Gotcha.
Or are we in a situation where the president himself does not have any interest in learning about the details of the policies he's putting forward? We're in such a basic set of questions now about the person in the office that it's pretty depressing.
Yeah. It can be fairly depressing to be at the bottom of a pyramid.
Yes.
You're writing a piece about Bernie Sanders tomorrow, about his single-payer health care plan.
Mm-hmm.
And tell me if I'm right about this. You're basically saying that whether or not this passes or becomes law, Bernie Sanders will have succeeded.
So this is, I think, a remarkable moment in American politics. We've just watched the healthcare debate transform pretty completely. I've covered healthcare really since I got into journalism. And single payer was an idea. I mean, it's always been there. It's obviously done in a lot of other countries. You would have liberals who were for it, but pretty quietly. Bernie Sanders kept introducing a single payer plan. It never got any co-sponsors in the Senate. And he has, in the last year, made single payer into the mainstream position of the Democratic Party. And so the argument I'm making in this piece is that the plan that he has created, and we can talk about why, I don't think that plan is going to pass. It would mean 250 million Americans see their current insurance canceled, tax increases of a level we have never done in this country before. But what he's done, I think, is refashion what the Democratic Party's goal is. And so then the way the next Democratic administration, whether it be his or someone else's, is going to try to move healthcare policy forward is in this single-payer-ish direction. So maybe you do a Medicare buy-in where now anybody, not just people over 65, can get Medicare or a Medicaid buy-in. You add a strong public option to Obamacare. You do negotiations with drug companies. He has really recentered what it means to have a good healthcare policy in the Democratic Party. And so even if his particular plan doesn't pass, the things that are going to come next are going to be descendants of it.
Well, whichever way it goes, I will be looking forward to reading about it because you are one of the wonkiest people when it comes to healthcare out there.
Thank you. I will take that as a compliment.
It is a compliment, I promise. You did a fantastic, fascinating interview, almost an hour with Hillary Clinton. And one of the parts of the conversation that I found so riveting is she talked about being at a disadvantage running against a candidate like Donald Trump who had no shame. Can you explain a little bit as to what that point was?
So this, to me, is the most central feature of Donald Trump, that he does not have shame. I don't want to put this on Hillary Clinton too much.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't
no,
think she quite
said
it. No, we all
know he doesn't have shame. Yeah. Oh, did you hear that observation that she made that I would never have thought?
I think one of the central recognitions of this era has been how much we rely on shame to discipline our politicians. How many things that we think are independent parts of the political system that keep people in check, the media's power, other things like that, are actually politicians getting criticism and deciding, hey, I don't want to be talked about like that. I don't want people to call me a liar. I don't want them to call me a white supremacist sympathizer. I'm going to not do things that give people that impression.
Yeah, it's worked pretty well for
a long time.
It's
worked okay, because most people have shame.
Yeah.
But this is why I think it's always really important to remember Donald Trump was a reality star, not really a businessman.
Yeah.
What he is an amazing brander. And in fact, why he's an amazing brander is that he would put his name on things other people would not put their name on. Like, Donald Trump does not drink, but he has his name on a vodka.
Yeah.
Like, that's just peculiar.
Right.
That is a peculiar way to do your business. And one thing that's really great if you're a reality star is not to have shame, to be able to do things that keep the camera on you, even when it would normally go over to someone else. But in politics, where we actually need shame to discipline people into not being demagogues, into not whipping up the worst passions of the population, into not saying things that are completely untrue just because they will give you political benefit, it turns out that missing that shame gland is actually might in some ways be a political advantage, but it's dangerous for the country.
Do you think over the course of the last couple of days, the way he's swinging back on DACA, do you think that is maybe the development of some level of shame that he feels so bad about the idea, like some humanity's coming through if I don't want to send these people away?
I do not think shame is in any way responsible for what is happening here with DACA. I wish that it were. I think Trump is trying to find his way forward, and he knows this is not going well. This is a guy whose primary motivating force in life is to be popular, is to have people like him. he is an incredibly unpopular president. And as much as I think he tries to sequester himself from that fact, he can't do it for too long. Eventually, it comes out. A lot of the people around him who are pushing the hardest anti-immigration politics in his administration, like Bannon, are out. Jeff Sessions has fallen out of favor with him. So he's got, I think, more moderate voices around him. So he's trying something a little bit different. And I think he's getting praise, so he's continuing to try it.
So the weather vane is just spinning around.
The weather vane is spinning.
Yeah.
But this is a problem, that his preferences here aren't stable. And so it doesn't mean that anything different is going to happen in a week. It also doesn't mean that any of this itself will pass. Where he ends up at the end of a debate is often not very well related to what he says in the middle. But for now, DACA is a very important program. I mean, I think this is a genuinely positive development. And if he decides a way to be a bit more popular is to try to create a governing coalition with some Democrats and some Republicans, that would be certainly a step forward.
Well, I certainly look forward to seeing if that'll happen. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank
Evan Klein, everybody.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle at Late Night Seth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
Business can mean a lot of things. For some, it's earning reports, the top MBA program, investments, but business isn't everything we do. Side hustles that explode into the next billion-dollar company.
I need to create my own product that I control what the marketing is for.
Unconventional ideas that change the world we live in.
AI is everywhere, with venture capital pouring in.
From Elon Musk,
he took a massive axe and swung it through Twitter's workforce.
To Taylor Swift,
she is unstoppable as her Eras Tour stimulated local economy.
Your favorite coffee shop down the street to the vacation house you rented last weekend. Whatever business means to you, Wondery is the destination for business podcasts. Listen to top business shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Everything from top daily news.
There was more ranch dressing sold last year than ketchup and barbecue sauce.
We're buying the dip, literally.
To deep dives on the biggest successes and failures of our time.
20,000 people lost their jobs.
Wondery means business.